Welcome, coughing friends. Another practice period. It's too late now. It's begun. Now we have to finish it. And it looks like it's going to be 9 weeks. Practice period is a funny thing that we just pick out these periods, these times, and say we're going to practice for this period. So 1 year, people took up this complete cycle around the sun of 1 year to delve more deeply into practice in particular forms of warming the jewel. And now we have 9 weeks. Starting tomorrow, we have 5-day sesshin, which has its own particular forms. So it's kind of arbitrary to set up a time, a period for practice, because everything is practice. And yet, something seems different when we do that. And also we can just say, okay, the practice period's begun today, but in our tradition we have these ways, like we just did, that might seem kind of strange, to enact the beginnings and endings and middles of things. we like enact it with body, speech, and mind. It's not just a mind thing, right? It's not just like, okay, it's time to practice now more. I'm going to try to practice more starting like around now and to around some other time. It's like we bring in not our just our mind, but our body and voice, and enact, ritually enact in this very, very ancient way, going way, way back in the centuries and centuries ago in China and Japan, beginning practice period, invoking these 10 names of Buddha. Well, it's almost about time up now. No, there's a little more time. So we're converging here at the opening of our practice period. We're starting a sesshin tomorrow, Genzo-e sesshin, that many of you are in parts of, where we're studying an essay by Dogen Zenji from the Shobo Genzo, the True Dharma Eye Treasury, called Valley Sounds, Mountain Colors. So I'm going to bring that up a bit. And also, we're starting a class series next week as one of the practice period events on the Lanka Avatara Sutra. And also, the sesshin, this Genzo-e sesshin, is also memorializing Shakyamuni Buddha's Parinirvana, which is traditionally celebrated on February 15th. We want to do it a couple days early. So we have many threads going on here. The Buddha's Parinirvana, the Buddha's descent into Sri Lanka to teach the Lanka Avatara Sutra, about the mind and the workings of the mind. And we have Dogen's teaching on valley sounds of valley streams and the colors of the mountain. And of course, as always, all three of these threads are really about the same thing. So how to tie it all together in a few more minutes. Buddha's Parinirvana, we celebrate at the end of sesshin. Parinirvana means like, pari is like complete. So Buddha's complete nirvana, and it means when he let go of his body. He literally dropped off body and mind in a very literal way. It was like the end of his 80-year life. And we don't really say it's the time when the Buddha died, because the Buddha is said to have realized the deathless. So the Buddha, strictly speaking, wasn't born and didn't die. So it's not really like his death day. That's why we say it's his complete nirvana. And nirvana means like complete peace and freedom. So the Buddha finally let go of his body completely. He entered the complete, perfect peace. So it's a kind of solemn occasion where we make offerings to the Buddha and we chant the Buddha's last teaching, supposedly the Buddha's Parinirvana Brief Admonition Sutra. In the Great Vehicle, they say this is the Buddha's last teaching, and it's in the form of these eight practices that are wonderful, straightforward practices that are, we could say they're all about Zazen. He doesn't say that. But we could say these are like, if you're wondering what Zazen, Zen meditation, sitting meditation is, what's the mind of Zazen? One way to look at it is these eight factors. And for those in Sesshin, wondering what to do for all those days of sitting, here's one way to look at it. You can also look at it as just practices for outside of Zazen, just general life practices, because they're broad and all encompassing. So the Buddha said these eight practices are having few desires, which I thought was interesting that he doesn't say have no desires. We don't say, it's not the cessation of all desire. He said having few desires. Like, it's okay to, like in Sesshin, to want like a really comfortable zafu. Want some basic things. And you know, appreciate that food gets brought in and we get to eat it. And maybe extra desires would be like, wanting to bring in like kind of a lounge chair or a water bed or something into the zendo, or a big bean bag chair. Maybe that's a little extra. I mean, maybe for some people that might be still few. But wanting like, you know, a 5-course banquet for breakfast or something might be a little extra. But a few, it's okay to have a few. And that's like the mind of Zazen. We like, oh, I just want to shift the posture so that little crook in my back is a little more straightened out. That's like a little desire that's quite nice to have in Zazen. The second practice is contentment, knowing contentment, which is kind of the same thing. Just a few desires and contentment. Of course, we've all heard these things. They're straightforward practices, but each one of them is very profound, actually. Contentment, I really think, is like, I mean, contentment is like nirvana, actually. To be really completely content is almost like pari nirvana. But in Zazen, we can be content with the body and mind that we're receiving each moment, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. At least we can aspire to let the mind settle into the direction of contentment. And the third is the practice of serenity, a quiet, peaceful serenity, which of course in Zazen that's usually the case. But in daily life, to find times and places where we can be serenely quiet and appreciate the present more fully and easily, at least for some of the time. So the fourth practice is diligence. which in Zazen is to continue to practice the first three and all these others. And when many, many desires come up and much discontentment comes up and non-serenity comes up, to diligently release, let go again and again. The fifth practice is mindfulness, paying attention to the present moment. The sixth is concentration, which is a kind of an extension from mindfulness. Mindfulness is just being generally aware of what's happening around us and with us, and concentration would be more like gathering in the mind in a more focused way on one particular object or present experience. The word sesshin actually appears in the sutra. Sesshin meaning to gather the mind. The Buddha says, when you gather the mind like this, you can know concentration. And the seventh practice is wisdom, cultivating wisdom, understanding how things are, supported by all these other practices. Understanding how the Buddha was trying to teach us to be free. Wisdom and understanding. So we have to review again. Fewness of desires, contentment, serenity, diligence, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. And then lastly, the eighth one, they kind of almost seem like they're building on each other, don't they, into more and more settled and subtle practices of meditation. So the last one's kind of surprising. Here in this Chinese version of the sutra, it's like not having all kinds of idle discussions. So after all these settling into serenity, concentration, wisdom, then finally, just not getting distracted by idle discussions. It seems like such a kind of random thing to culminate these practices with. By the way, you can also find this Dogen's comments on the sutra in the Shobo Genzo. It was supposedly the last thing that Dogen ever wrote in his lifetime was this little section of the Parinirvana Sutra, just before Dogen's Parinirvana, commenting on these last teachings of the Buddha. He also says, it like not having idle, random discussions. But at some point I found this sutra from the early teachings of the Buddha, the Pali Canon, with these same 8 points. So it was, seems like this Mahayana Sutra was taken from the from this early sutra. And they're listed the same way, but the eighth is slightly different. So this might have been one of these things that got lost in translation from Pali and Sanskrit to Chinese. Got kind of like slightly skewed when somebody didn't quite know how to translate this term prapancha. In Sanskrit, prapan and Pali, papancha. Which seems to mean something like conceptual proliferation, conceptual constructions, or another translation is reference points to seemingly external objects that we fixate and believe in as like reference points in order to find ourself in relation to them. So this term prapancha doesn't appear so much in these early teachings, but it's really important in the, like the middle way teachings of Nagarjuna. He brings this up a lot, and these and the Lankavatara Sutra and these mind-only teachings bring up this term, so it's a nice bridge here, I think. That finally, when we've settled the mind, don't have too many desires, we're content, we're concentrated, with our wisdom understood basic teachings, then letting go of all conceptual proliferations and grasping conceptual constructions. So if we hear it like that, it really is a meditation practice, as opposed to just not having random idle discussions. You can see how they're somewhat related, right? But they really, one's really about talking externally and one's about talking internally. So the Lankavatara Sutra, we'll have this start this class soon, but here's another little preview from this Sutra of the Buddha. The Buddha says in verse, just like waves in a boundless sea, blown by a powerful wind, breakers in a black expanse, they never for a moment cease. This black, dark, nighttime ocean with breakers coming in, wave after wave, never ceasing. Just like this, in the ocean of the storehouse consciousness, the alaya vijnana, the we could say the unconscious sum of all our past experiences that we've ever had, we call the storehouse consciousness. So just like these waves in a boundless sea, in the ocean of this storehouse, stirred by the wind of externality, wave after wave of consciousness breaks and swells again. So this ocean storehouse of all our past experiences, all our karmic dispositions, everything we've ever done is kind of registered in here. It's a little bit like memory, but it's much more than memory too. It accounts for memory, but it also is registering stuff that we don't consciously even remember. According to this story of the Buddha, there's everything we've ever experienced is registered in a way in this storehouse of mine. And it's very still, like this vast ocean. So vast, right? If it's including everything that's ever happened to us. And as a metaphor, it's like a vast ocean and then these waves on the surface. And the waves on the surface are like the conscious mind emerging out of the unconscious mind. Our conscious experiences are like coming forward, and here we are. We're sitting in a zendo. This is just a little wave on the surface, and we just experienced this moment, and then that wave just sank back down into the vast ocean of the storehouse. And these waves of conscious experience are being stirred by the winds of externality. I think it's a great phrase, great way to put this. In other words, what seems to be external to mind. There's this vast ocean of mind, and then there seems to be external objects out there. And that's like the wind that stirs up our kind of active consciousness. And you could say the winds of externality are like this prapancha, these conceptual elaborations, the eighth part of nirvana practice of not giving rise to fixation on reference points in the external world, letting go of that separation between mind and its objects as being external, as being distinctly and inherently and truly out there, apart from mind. In the ocean of the storehouse consciousness, stirred by the wind of externality, wave after wave of consciousness breaks and swells again. Like the ocean and its waves, being neither separate nor not separate, right? An ocean and its waves are not really separate. The waves are not separate from the ocean, but they're not really exactly the same. One's a wave on the surface and one's the vast ocean. Like the ocean and its waves are neither separate nor not separate, these seven forms of consciousness rise together with this basic mind or storehouse consciousness. So this is something we'll get into in the class, these other seven, which are basically five sense consciousnesses and a conceptual consciousness. And then the seventh is the sense of self. We could say like the self consciousness that actually creates these conceptual elaborations and believes that they're actually separate from mind. Like the ever-changing sea gives rise to different waves, the repository storehouse consciousness gives rise to different forms. As the ocean and its waves cannot be divided, the mind and the forms of consciousness cannot be separated. The mind, the basic storehouse, is what gathers karma, what accumulates our karmic experiences. Karma just means like all our intentional actions. The will, he translates here as will, is the seventh consciousness of, we could say like our free will, our sense of control and the self-control. That considers what is gathered. So the storehouse, the eighth consciousness, gathers in all our karmic experiences. The will, or the seventh consciousness, the self, sense of self, starts assessing like, oh, that was a good thing I just did, or that wasn't so good. It's kind of making all these judgments. And the other six consciousnesses are conscious of all the sense objects and conceptual objects. So that's just a little taste of this sutra, one of the main themes running through. And just to include this last thread as a little prelude to the sesshin tomorrow, and a very different style, but not such a different teaching, right? These things are always the same points. Dogen brings up this interesting and beautiful essay about the sounds of valley streams and the color of mountains. And he, pretty near the beginning, he quotes this poem that's the source of the title, a poem from Su Dongpo, the great Chinese poet you might know, from maybe like the 11th century. And this is one of maybe his most classic poem. You might have heard this. He was already a poet, and he went up out to the mountain one night meditating, and then had some, well, as Dogen says, he was enlightened to the way upon hearing the sound of the valley stream. And then he wrote this poem that the sounds of the valley stream are the long, broad tongue of the Buddha. The colors of the mountains are the pure body. You could say, he doesn't say of the Buddha, but he's referring to one of the marks of a Buddha is this long, broad tongue and this pure body. So he's saying, the Buddha's true body and voice is the sounds of valley streams and the colors and forms of the mountains. 84,000 verses are heard throughout the night. What can I say about this at a future time? Or like, what can I, how can I express this the next day? He awakened to the Buddha's true body through the sound of the valley streams at night and the dark forms of the mountain, expressing the truth of suchness. 84,000 verses heard through the night in the, as the sound of the valley stream. And how could this ever be expressed in words the next day? And he tried, right, by writing this poem. And we get a sense of it. And we know such experiences. I think we have such experiences. And sometimes we... what can we say, right? Nature is just expressing itself all the time. And sometimes it touches us really deeply and awakens our kind of stale, old relationship to nature, where it's like, yeah, that's a mountain, that's a stream, that's a tree. I've seen them before. It's just another tree. We don't even see the tree, right? This is like when you really hear the sound, really see the form of the mountain. And just to tie it all together, right? This is like, at this moment, I would propose that Su Dong Po had let go of all prapancha at this time of hearing the valley stream and seeing the color of the mountain. There was no conceptual proliferation. There were no fixed reference points of an external stream and mountain out there apart from mind. And he probably worked up to that by sitting there with few desires and contentment and serenity and diligence, mindfulness, concentration. And just opened to that sound. Any questions or anything to bring up before some of us enter 5 days of virtual silence? Yes, Edie.
You were talking about the eighth point of idle conversation. I thought of the last line in merging of difference and unity where the stone was.
Yes.
So, and then you
went to yeah, don't waste time in idle conversation. But you could also say, you know, in a maybe more strict way, you could say that this prapancha, this conceptual proliferation is, again, in a kind of strict way, we could say that that's wasting time. I say strict because we're doing it basically almost continuously. So you could say everything we're basically doing is slightly wasting time compared to just hearing the sound of the valley stream, seeing the color of the mountain directly with no conceptual mediation and as fixed reference points in relation to a self. Also, in just before, Shuto says, "Don't waste time." Is right. Like, if you are confused, mountains and rivers block the way. And Dogen touches on some of these ideas. If we're confused, these sounds of the rivers and the form of the mountains block the way, and they seem like stuff that we have to deal with. But truly, progress is not a matter of far or near. That in that realm, where there's not a bunch of stuff we have to out there, external stuff that we have to overcome, then we can truly not waste time. And in fact, another way to put it together too is that time is a conceptual construction. So if we don't construct time, we can't really waste it. But this is really difficult to not construct time. Especially it's challenging right now. And also in Sesshin, when everything just goes by this schedule. So it's just like, in a way, Sesshin practice is just about like surrendering to this, to a bunch of constructed time things. Like, sit down now, get up and walk now. Sit down, walk, sit, walk, eat, chant, sit, walk, eat, chant. and it's all like laid out there in the schedule. It's just conceptual construction that we do that, but it's like to see if we can dance with this and see through, you know, the conceptual construction while dancing in the midst of it. We could also maybe say that's not wasting time. Yes?
Launching into Sesshin, I hope this might be helpful. I apologize in advance if it becomes a hindrance. But maybe the no idle conversation also refers to no idle self-conversation. It's not like language stops during Sesshin. You know, there might be idle self-talk that we can also convince ourselves to say, well,
with myself. Sorry. Yes, yes. I think that's very much true. I think that's the connection, actually, between this sutra in the Chinese version and Dogen's translation saying no idle conversation, and then this early Pali one saying, instead of saying idle conversation, it says like this thing like conceptually proliferating. It sounds like a more internal thing. So, but to put it even more simply, kind of useless, idle conversations with ourself. And I mean, saying no means, of course, we do that, but it's not like we can stop that completely, but we have a chance in Sesshin especially to really relax that obsessional quality of the mind that loves to tell itself stories. Thank you. And for Sesshin, well, maybe that, you know, can invite people to various parts, you know, if you would like to come in. Thank you for being here at this opening of practice period. And warming the jewel, and these things that just keep rolling on like this, and it's just about us. It's just about these human beings intending to come together and practice this inconceivable way. May all beings hear the valley sounds running through the night and see directly the color of the mountains and the buildings and streets. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.